Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing the first half of an interview I did with the remarkable Ed Asner. In this half of the interview, he talks about the beginnings, the beginning of his life, the beginning of his career. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh, I really can. Oh, I really can. Turn down all the noise so I can hear that sweet voice sing. Oh, you really.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about being who you really are, being true to yourself. And if you've listened to the show before, you know that I usually talk about that, about why we are not who we really are, how we can recapture who we really are, why that's important, and related issues. And I also play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. Today, I'm not going to talk anymore. I am simply going to play the first half of the interview I did with the, I can't think of enough adjectives to describe Ed Asner. He's charming, he's funny, he's talented, he's available, he's generous. And he is so definitely who he is that he's the poster child for The Lynn Show. So this part of the interview, in this part of the interview, he talks about his early life, how he got started, how he discovered his interest in acting, and a series of disappointing experiences which he managed to endure, learn from, and go on from. It's remarkable. So I'm not going to say any more except to say this is the extraordinary Ed Asner.
So I'm here with Ed Asner.
Don't be overwhelmed.
I just want to make sure it's recording because sometimes I don't record and I don't want not to get this.
Yeah, you're not an electronic whiz.
Oh, yay. Technologically incompetent.
Me too. I was trained as a radar repairman.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
A radar repairman?
Mm-hmm. In the Army. Good thing they never put one on my hands. Or put me on it.
We would have had a lot of downed planes.
So, the universe was kind.
Mm-hmm.
I do this internet radio show, and for it, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
You call what I do art, sister?
Yes, brother, I do.
Boy, are you off the base.
Well, what would you call it then?
Getting rid of excess adrenaline.
Yes, and at the same time, as you are getting
getting into a fight.
Truly. And at the same time as you are getting rid of your excess adrenaline, other people manage to be entertained. How clever of you.
Well, the amazing thing is they never see the strings.
Well, maybe you will tell us about them.
Well, they may well imagine psychological strings.
Yes.
The director certainly will.
So, this is it. I always ask the same question. And it is, when did this career of acting occur to you? When did it start? What was the very first moment that it occurred to you that you would want to act, or that acting would be something that would compel you, or I'm not sure how you would think about it, but the very beginning?
I think it always was there.
Yes.
The desire to jump up and down and blow imaginary farts. It was always there, but I was from a bourgeois family in Kansas City, Kansas. And you didn't think in those terms. Those were the grown-ups out there who were either gorgeous enough or melodious enough to succeed at those distant things called movies and radio. I did radio in high school.
Well, wait. I want you to talk about the desire to jump up and down and do imaginary farts. Did you?
No, a lot of times they weren't imaginary.
But did you entertain for your family? I mean, were you a show-off? Were you a jokester? Were you the family or the school
I was
clown?
The jokester, but my brother was the scheming jokester. He would lay traps.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah.
For
and,
you?
For everybody. And he would scheme, and he was a regular Ulysses. And I was kind of a jumping jack clown, and all the way until I got into high school, and I was viewed as a clown by my peers.
So was that did it please you?
No.
Oh.
No, it pleased me while I was doing it, and then there was always the depression afterwards, as there is with almost all clowns.
Yes. So you knew that even then. You knew even then that the activity was energizing, but there was a price.
Yeah, that you weren't being taken seriously.
Oh, God, right.
That's a very... again, I certainly regarded my blood as serious blood. My flesh as serious.
Yes. Well, and this is it seems to me quite a dilemma if you have an inclination to entertain and you can't... And it drives you, it motivates you to do that, and then later you have regret?
Yeah, which is why when my junior and senior year in high school, when I went into radio, it became perfect because then I could be the leading man and sweep you off your feet and feel your kisses and feel my kisses. Able to sell myself as this glorious, monstrous, handsome devil.
Yes.
And never had to expose myself.
Yes. I understand, as I do radio. It's a magic medium.
Well, little do your listeners know that I am that gorgeous, handsome devil, and you are the ravishing beauty queen that you're reputed to be. So.
And we're going to ride off into the sunset any minute now.
If the horse ever shows up.
So this is so interesting to me. So you had an opportunity that a lot of people don't have to reinvent yourself on the radio, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And it must have been also very compelling, seductive.
Well, you look at the famous voices of radio, for Christ's sake, yeah. Martin Gable.
Oh, yes.
Never swept you off your feet.
No.
Well, what's his name? Yeah. Note of Triumph and all that.
Beautiful. Norman
Corwin.
I interviewed him.
Beautiful.
He's 101 years old.
Yeah.
And he talked about, he loved Martin Gable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he thought Martin Gable was better than...
Orson Welles?
Right, he thought Martin Gable was better than Orson, and he used Orson, too.
And though I enjoyed it all, I, at the same time, being in Kansas City, Kansas, high school radio program, you don't think it's... go to the big city and get into radio. You don't create vistas that easily.
Wow. How old were you?
17, 18.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I went to the University of Chicago instead.
And what did you major in?
You didn't major at that time. You took placement tests, which determined what courses.
They told you what to do.
Yeah. Which is fine.
Yeah.
Make sure that you had got a well-rounded education, which would give you your Chicago BA, which was not accepted everywhere.
Oh.
But you had an education. And I hardly approved of that. And along the way, I decided to go to summer school because I wanted to get out of college as quickly as possible. And my little roommate, who was from Newark, was in the theater group, which was all extracurricular. And he heard me read one day. They were doing a radio, a closed-circuit radio at our dormitory system. And I said, well, I did radio in high school. What do you think? He thought I was a hick from Kansas who played football. It really kind of ridiculous for him to listen to me. But he said, well, let me hear you read. So they had given me a copy of the Song of Songs. And so I stood at one end of the room and read to him. And his little jaw fell open. Where did you learn to read like that? Yeah, I went, oh, shucks. So, he was impressed. I did a role on the radio show. And time went on, and then he came home, bustling home one day. He was in the theater group, as I said. He came bustling home, and he said, you're going to summer school, and listen, they're going to do Murder in the Cathedral as the summer show, play. Check the book out. You can do any of the characters in it. I checked the book out. I didn't read it. I went to the reading. I read. And through a series of circumstances, I ended up doing the lead. And that hooked me.
Yeah.
As well as starting an affair with the lady of the chorus.
Both hooked you.
Yes.
So when you say that hooked you...
So it was always, to me, it was always... theater and sex, they go arm in arm.
Yeah, yeah.
Or leg in leg.
Yeah, or something and something,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, they're both, I'll use the word again, seductive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They get the heart pumping.
But you think sex is seductive?
I do.
Get your hands off me.
It's hard.
It is.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm interested, you know, that I was hooked. Does that mean I felt alive, I felt at home, I felt excited, I wanted to do this? What does that mean?
I did the lead 2 out of 3 nights. The third night, the other guy who had appeared for Thomas was given that choice, and so I would do the fourth tempter. The second night I did it, which was the last night, Shag Donahue ran the Red Door Bookshop, which is a wonderful little bookshop. forget what the street was. And 57th Street. What am I talking about? Sure. And he played the third tempter. And the tempters and the priests are all lined up on either side of the stage while I'm doing the last sermon and the last soliloquy. And when I finish the soliloquy, he's up on his perch, and as the curtain came down, he said, "Terrific, terrific." And I, like a Jew at the Wailing Wall, nodded, "Yes, yes, 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 I was." And it sent me to the rafters, that accomplishment. And it was hard to resist.
Mm-hmm.
I shortly thereafter, with my father's help, pulled out of college.
With your father's help?
Yeah, he stopped paying.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I was involved with the shiksa, and he found out.
Oh, wow. And so he punished you?
Well, he also knew I wasn't going to...
Give it up?
Wasn't going to class, either.
Oh, well. Yeah. Okay, so he
was right.
Yeah, he was right, and you were lucky.
And at the time, I was already cast as Crayon in Oedipus Rex, which was to happen in February. This is after the Christmas vacation. The revelation came, and that's when he pulled the plug.
He said, "Not on my dime."
So I went back to Chicago to supposedly get my stuff together, blah, blah, blah. And everybody told me, you got to stay, you got to do Crayon, you got to do Crayon. I said, "All right." So I called home, and my little bird. You want to see?
Oh, him? Yes.
That's a red, black-throated Phoebe. That's the name.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he comes and he digs in the garden, and gets a bug or two.
Oh, look at him! He's beautiful.
Yeah, he's a perky little bastard.
Yeah.
I love him.
You called home.
Called home to say that I am coming home, but I'll come home after the play is we're finished performing the play. And my sister was doing the talking. She was carrying the messages from my father off camera. And he said, "Listen, tell him he didn't make it as a student. He won't make it as an actor." And I said, "Well, I'll be the judge of them." And then, subsequent to that, I don't know if it was in that conversation or another time, he said, "Now, if you could sing like Eddie Fisher, then I can understand." But I said, "Well, I don't sing like Eddie Fisher, but I'm still staying as an actor." And so that lasted for, that alienation was short term, really.
Mm-hmm.
When I finally came out of the Army and joined Playwrights Theater Club in Chicago, and I waited for the proper time, and finally I was going to do Rabbi Azrael in the Dibbuk. I said it'd be a good time for him and Mom to come up and see me do the show.
So is that the first time they saw you on stage?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, sorry. That's when they should.
Yeah.
So she cooked up a bunch of chicken and brought it to the hotel that they were staying at. I told him I was in charge of the cleaning detail at the theater. And this one, when they came to the theater, they... came up the stairs and from an ill-used, from a rarely used stairwell, and his hands were twice as big as mine. His nails were cracked and black from the work all his life. There he is up there in that picture up there. He's on the right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
He said, listen, you're in charge of the cleaning. Is that stair, that handrail is dirty. You gotta see that that's taken care of.
Yep.
I said, you're right, Pop. You're right. I'll get on it. They saw the show that night. It was a 180-seat theater. And, yeah, good seats. And, a couple of girls sat next to my mother, and when I was going through my tzimmis on the stage, she nudged one of them and said, that's my son. Said, oh, he's wonderful, he's wonderful. And she nodded, yes, of course. And then he gruntingly said it was good. I later found out that he went back to Kansas City and said, hi, Nodula. So he seemed so old. My father was in close to 80 by this time. He seemed so old. I wanted to get up on that stage and help him. So I knew I...
You had it. Oh, my God. That's so glorious.
Yeah, it is.
It's wonderful, too, that you got that. Mm-hmm. Who told you that he said that? Do you remember?
Oh, one of my siblings,
right.
I guess.
Right. So, okay, so now you're, what, in your 20s?
Mm.
Right? And you're a working actor. You're a part of a company, right? So you're... And you're in where? You're in Chicago?
Yeah, that only lasted 2 years.
So then?
By that time, Paul was getting into improv theater. He started The Compass, which, mm-hmm. which sprang off Mike and Elaine and Shelley Berman. And Barbara Harris. Yeah.
And you?
I was too bourgeois to think. Oh, I was also too... too ego-driven to...
Submerge yourself.
Submerge myself in improv. And I wanted to take the reviews I had garnered and rush to New York with them.
And be a star.
Hmm.
It's interesting that you keep mentioning this bourgeois thing. You don't feel the slightest bit bourgeois.
I don't what?
Feel bourgeois.
Oh, I think it's the natural state.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
And you think you are, still?
Yeah.
Well, you hide it so well.
Well, maybe I work at it.
Maybe. Well, it's successful.
Yeah.
But then you're an actor.
Mm.
Okay. Mm. So you said, very nice, guys, but I don't want to do this, and here are my wonderful reviews, and I'm on my way to New York.
Yeah, well, they had been working Compass for a good while. At the same time, we were doing Playwrights, the last 6 months of Playwrights. And I suppose tentative mention was made to me, but I had no burning interest to pursue it. Not many of the actors in our group did, and they certainly weren't busy recruiting them. They were full.
They had enough.
They had the people. So I took my reviews and ran. And when I saw the subsequent smash hit of Mike and Elaine,
Well, perhaps that was not the smartest thing I ever did.
Okay, but it would. I don't really think I envied them their success. I envy a lot of people their success, and I want to reduce it, if possible.
Other people's success.
Yeah. But I didn't feel that way necessarily about them. And I still didn't want to become the master of improv.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I have to say, I think I'm good at it. Pick up Kleenex, the cheeks of my ass so easily.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Yeah. I'll show you.
I can't wait. I'm so sorry it's not video.
Well, I'll have to take our word for it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Ooh!
Not yet. Let's hope the Kleenex stays clean.
Right.
Yeah.
So you went to New York with your reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And how old are you now then?
New York was 55. So I would be 26.
Okay.
25.
Okay. Young and hungry and coming off success.
Yeah, I got to New York and I said, well, Zora Lampert was one of our companies. She was regarded as a star already by many. So I was going to go along and hopefully be a shadow to her success.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got to New York and I was fortunate to see my Oedipus, who was living in New York by this time, and he had an apartment that he could share with me, 3rd and 15th. So I moved in with him. It was a walk-up, and roaches and bedbugs and everything. But it was fine. I think it cost $72, $76 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then I didn't expect to get anywhere, but I would, I got whatever directories and guides were out for actors at the time, and I just blocked them off, and I'd go to producers' offices and agents' offices every day within a certain area, leave my picture and resume, and hopefully hear from them, and I'm sure that in most cases they threw it right in the wastebasket. So, but at the same time, I looked up Carmen Capalbo and Stanley Chase, who were the producers of Threepenny, and looked them up very early. And they, we had done a pirated version of Threepenny in Chicago.
Do you sing? Do you sing?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Well, I'm not a trained singer, but I sing.
You're not as good as Eddie Fisher.
That's right. But where's he now?
Yeah, really?
So I was looking for a job. So they were intrigued by my chutzpah to come there after I participated in the pirated version. And, they took my picture and they said they'd call. And sometime they called in December. You don't like that?
No, I like it, but it makes noise and I didn't need any more of it.
Mm.
So I'm waiting for it.
We're talking about a piece of candy, folks.
Yeah.
I had agreed to do a walk-on, which was what it turned out to be. I howled like a wolf. A production of Venice Preserved, a one-night presentation at the Phoenix Theater. And I said, oh, I was committed to that. And I wanted to cut my wrist. I said, oh, don't worry about it. Jobs are always coming up. In the show, replacements. We'll call again. I said, okay. So come February, they called me again. To come in and do Bob the Saw, one of the crooks. So I came in. Immediately came down with strep throat.
Oh, gee.
Was out for a week. Bob the Saw had to understudy the police chief, the third male of the show. Leon Janney was doing Peachum, which is a role I had done in Chicago. Leon Janney finally announced that he was leaving, and the guy playing the police chief was leaving like a week earlier, and Leon feeling for me and knowing how much I wanted to do Peachum, said, All right, I'll tell him early. He was a great, decent guy, and he gave his notice. And I said, I'd like to audition for that role. So they heard me, and they said, okay.
Wow.
And I went in and did Peach and I did it for 2.5 years. I was a very psychologically disturbed fellow. I didn't believe in what I was doing. I was fitting the mold. There was no individualistic input. I wasn't able to give any of my own creed, and the guilt haunted me.
Really? Well, so I have a bunch of questions about that. You knew it at the time that you were not investing yourself in it.
Investing myself, yes, but being somebody else's puppet.
Right, but not you, right? You knew it at the time. You did it because you thought it was expedient, or because you, I don't know.
Well, you're all based on timing, roughly the
right.
same timing.
Right.
You can't take too long on your soliloquy because people are waiting in the wings.
Right.
Or you can't take too long on an answer because...
Somebody has a response.
Mrs. Peachup may have the next laugh.
Right,
it's that kind of crap.
So are you saying it couldn't be done in that play, or that you...
Well, I'll tell you what. Mm-hmm. Haunted by this guilt forever and ever and ever. And along came Evergreen Books came out with the paperback version of the Threepenny novel.
Mm-hmm.
By Brecht, but written after the success of Threepenny. And I read it, and I said, oh, my God, that's Peachum. Oh, my God, how wonderful. I've got to become that man. I've got to become that man. Which was not the man in the play as we were doing it.
Wow.
So I went out there, sang my opening song in the first act. Wake up, you damn godless, wake up. Come open your sinful blue eyes. Da 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 da. Hello, Wheezy. How's my baby?
Oh, I didn't remember that in the play.
Hey, my baby.
Hello.
So.
Wheezy is a beautiful cat.
Yes, he is, isn't he?
Yes, oh my goodness, with beautiful blue eyes.
He's been out in the sun.
Yes. Hi, Wheezy. Mm-hmm. Want to be in the... mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's all right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, I decided I was going to do it a la the Evergreen, the Threepenny novel.
Right.
So I went out there, sang my song, the first... speech to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And, I tried my first alteration, maybe my second alteration, but in there were two laughs that I normally get.
Mm-hmm.
The last didn't happen. And I said, oh, sweet Jesus, I can't do this any longer. And like a goddamn coward, I jumped back into my mold. Never tried it again.
Is that what you regret?
Yeah, but I was too young. I mean, what? Mm-hmm. Why the hell should I? And finally, when I was in the show long enough, I went to the weirdest psychological torture you could ever imagine. My inner voice told me, get out of here, go become a person. So I'd come to the show and I'd say, oh, I'm going to blank out in the first scene. Didn't matter whether I went over the lines or not. I'm sure I didn't go over the lines, but it didn't matter.
It's the inner, it's the Civil War.
Yeah. I went in and did the first scene, and for several nights at least, I would just be on the verge of blanking out and then would come up with the words, finally. the last moment. Rode, as of course, was in control.
Right.
And Rode did it, but I allowed myself to be a disturbed person inwardly. And not until I got to the very edge of the brink could I successfully and prove to myself that I knew the next word or the next line.
Oh, my God, how...
And then came back from the brink, and then it would begin with the second scene, then the third scene. So it took place over a period of 2 weeks. I went through this torment, which would have deranged a weaker person.
I'm sure, and you must have been exhausted.
I can't remember anything else except the mental torture I was going through. And finally, I went through all the scenes and survived them all. I think maybe one time I put in a different word, maybe, than was written. And could then go on. But when I finally left the show, I left it to be a replacement in another off-Broadway show, smaller house. It had gotten the best reviews of the season. It was Ivanov. But the newspaper strike was on, so nobody knew about it. But I went in to take Jack Bittner's place, and I developed the character as I wished to see him develop, and I felt so fucking free.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Just thinking about that period of,
yeah,
in Threepenny, and I've become exhausted just thinking about it.
I believe it. Well, you were at war with yourself, weren't you?
Yeah.
There's nothing more exhausting than that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find myself thinking is that you must have been an actor from, as you say, the beginning. Because when you were able to be the actor you wanted to be, that is what enlivened you. That is what was so freeing. That was what,
yeah,
you know, it's wonderful. It's that you were yourself finally.
Well, I suppose that applies to all those acting teachers I went to. I never found any of them satisfactory or pertinent. I studied with Mira Rostova, and I think I studied with her and liked her because I innately did what her method was.
Anyway, that was your natural way to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so now you're about 28, 30? Not even?
I don't know. What year are you at?
Ivanov.
Oh. I left that in, I left Threepenny in the winter of 58. So I was 27.
27? So what you said? You're still very young, and now you're in New York. But you're really an established actor.
No, why?
Well, you're working for God's sake.
Oh, is that an established actor?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there are lots of guys like you have still not even gotten a role, and they're trying. Ooh, you know. So,
well, the guy who had been with us in Chicago, mm-hmm, actor Bob Kidd, New York actor who came out to Chicago, and he had gotten up a reading of a group of us, of Marlowe's Edward II, and he... they had Monday night openings at the Delice, where we performed Threepenny. So I was busy doing one of the leads in Edward II. And he wanted to take it to Lucille Ortel, the owner of the theater, see if we'd get a Monday night gig there. So we did. We did the reading. She said yes, that she would have us do the Monday night reading, but that only if a protege of hers could t- take my role. And Bob met with us and said, I feel we should say no. And I'm looking at these actors, none of whom had jobs. And I said, no. I've got a job. And this is to get you jobs. So, by all means, take the bitch's offer. And I'll go on. And they did. Nothing ever came of it. And, you know, you do something like that. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not saying that anything would have come of it. But I think each individual actor had to be somewhat disheartened at doing that with that kind of condition.
Right. You're saying that you think that it's possible that the disheartening had an impact on the production.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
I believe you're right. We don't separate all
I would have
world.
I would have been disheartened. I would have.
Right.
I mean, I might have gone out there and said, "Oh, give it full bore," you know.
Right.
But if I followed the silver tassie long enough, I might find the disheartening at the bottom of it.
Yeah, and I think that there had to be a bad feeling about the guy, the protege, and so it's hard to really to work with him or without that being in there somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So okay, so then, what happened then?
Oh, I did a few shows at this point. I was 58. Summer of 59, I got married, and the agency got me into Stratford. I think it's because my wife was part of the agency.
So
got me into Stratford, Connecticut, and the contract read as cast, which meant you do shit jobs.
Right.
So I did the shit jobs, and I did them well. And we had a gorgeous time, because for the first time in my life, I wore boots that were made for me, skin-tight tights. I mean, luxuriant wardrobe. And so came back to New York, and got together on another couple or more off-Broadway shows, and I'd scored big in Chicago with being Prospero in The Tempest.
Mm.
And the director of The Tempest came to town, and he wanted to reprise that Triumph. Couldn't get the actual cast that we had then, improvised for the most part. We put it on 74th Street Theater. And it was Brooks Atkinson's Next to the Last review. And he came there and he said, I, as Prospero, sounded like a train conductor. And I was not disheartened. I was just mad as hell. Mad because I knew that by the time the son of a bitch would see me again and
right.
eat his words,
right.
he'd already be retired.
Right. 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 Right.
So that's what I was just mad. And then the summer of 60 came along, and the assholes at Stratford offered me shitty roles again.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no thing. And Face of a Hero had been a success on Playhouse 90. Rip Torn had starred in it. So they got together this production. So Sandy McKendrick, the great director of all the Guinness movies, was the director. And we started off, and I saw him the day, at the cocktail party, the day before, the night before rehearsals began. He said, loved your reading. Of course, you can't be that funny. And the character was written, to my knowledge, both for the perjury and the laughs.
Right.
I said, well, he's the great director. He'll protect me.
Right.
He didn't do shit for me. Tried to bury me, actually, in certain many ways. So, once again, I was hating what I was doing, hating what he was directing.
Was this live theater or this was film?
Fee theater. Mm-hmm. So, we go all the way, finally end up in Boston. And they finally brought in Harold Clearman to take over. And he tried to restructure the leads primarily. Told me to just go on doing what I was doing. And for a few days it succeeded, but then he left.
And
the actors reverted to their former fuck-up. So we finally got to New York, and it didn't get good reviews. It didn't get terrible reviews, but it just was flat. And we had to close by Christmas. And I thought, well, there's my Broadway debut, and whoopee. I was very disappointed. So that brings us to, then I got a Naked City. I established myself with a Naked City.
Is that your first TV?
Well, I had been working Sunday morning shows, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, I had been doing, working under fives and over fives in Studio One, Armstrong Circle Theater,
mm-hmm.
Omnibus. I've been working my way up. Did the Naked City. That was my first really... Decoy was my first film TV, and it was a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And then this was next. And... I like doing it, and I like the effect of it. I think it was also Robert Duvall's first TV.
Ooh.
So then, did a Route 66 in New Orleans, sent down to the same people. With Bruce Dern, it came off well. Came back, and then they decided in March to shoot two Naked Cities back to back. Simultaneously. So Paul Burke and I were sent to L.A. the first time they were out of L.A. really. To extradite Bobby Blake and Frank Sutton, two brothers. And Harry Belliver and Horace McMahon stayed and did a show in New York. So it introduced me to Hollywood. And everybody said, you got to meet this one, you got to meet that one, you got to meet that one. And I'm busy going around meeting everybody. And finally met an agent or two who wanted me. So I called my wife. First I said, I want to take another week and meet some of these people. And she said, oh, shit. I took the other week. I met the people, and I finally decided I wanted to. So I agreed with the agent. I also did Claudius at Ellis Rabb's Theater. Mm-hmm. That was a good Claudius. We moved in May. I got a Route 66 to do in Youngstown, Ohio, which I was going to do on the way. So did the Route 66, and we zigzagged our way across America, pulling a 14-foot U-Haul. Got to the north rim of Grand Canyon and all that, saw that, and Zion National Park, Las Vegas, Albuquerque. We did the whole thing.
Route 66. Mm-hmm. So we're talking now about the 60s. No? 1960s?
Got here 61, May of 61. Mm-hmm. Stopped in Vegas and then played a few slot machines. It was a Friday. And I had arrangements to stay with a friend in Hollywood. So, got in and started driving in towards Vegas. And all I saw were a sea of lights coming at me. Mm. From the moment we left Vegas to the moment we got to L.A. And I thought, Jesus Christ, they must have dropped the bomb.
Because everybody was leaving?
Everybody was leaving. Jesus Christ. Normal holiday weekend.
Right, that's right.
So we stayed with him about a week, 10 days, found a gorgeous little apartment on an estate up at the middle crossroads of Mulholland and Woodrow Wilson. Mm. We stayed there for about, let's see, the 61, till a year and a half we stayed there. And then found a house that Herbert Biberman, one of the Hollywood 10, was the salesman on.
Oh, my. Mm.
It was a cantilever house, and we loved it. Mm-hmm. We bought it. Got a good deal.
So now you're in Hollywood.
How far are you taking me?
As far as you'll go.
I don't think I've got that kind of energy.
I don't know.
My mama's Jewish prince.
Yes.
After my father died, and I was appearing in guest shots on TV, I'd call home and tell Mom. And after I called on one particular show that I was going to be on, and she said, "Well, Viva's wrong, and I'm glad."
Oh, that's so sweet.
Those words are emblazoned on my mind.
I'm in your heart, I'm sure. So sweet.
Viva's wrong, and I'm glad.
But you know they can only give you what they have, right? They can't know the future.
No.
So much of your career was disappointing to you, and yet you've had an extraordinary career. So how did you wind up with the success that we all know you had?
So, as they say, tune in again next week to hear how it all turned out, how Ed Asner got the success that we all know he had, and also to hear more from this extraordinary man, a man who was able to discover so early in life what would be a through line in his life, and to follow it despite all of the difficulty, the early discouragement from his family, even though his mother comes around rather late in life to say that she's glad they were wrong, and kudos to her for being able to give him that. But what he didn't get was, yeah, you go, guy. You know, he didn't get the encouragement. So it all had to come from within him, from the strong sense that he knew who he was and that he knew what he had to do, even when it was so remarkably difficult. And of course, as I said at the beginning of the show, this is what makes him the poster child for the Lynn Show, because it is difficult to find our through line, to be who we really are. And it is not uncommon for us to have discouragement, not to be encouraged to find the real us, that the people who have a vested interest, whatever it is, in our being who they want us to be, continue to support that old version of us and are reluctant to accept our emergence into the person we really are. Fortunately for him and also for us, Ed was not only able to do that, but to turn it into a remarkable career and life. And as I said, if you tune in next week, you will hear how he did it. So now, as I only have a few minutes left, actually I don't even have a few minutes left, so I just want to thank Josh Hackney for all of his amazing technological help and support, and to tell you that you can find Josh, and also not only this show, but all of my shows, up on my website, The Lynn Show, thelynneshow, thelynnshow.com. And to say that, as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show, something that will bring you back, because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station, as will Ed Asner. And I hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.